Benjamin Franklin's quip that in this life nothing can be seen as certain except death and taxes should have included political parties. Americans have always considered party controversial at best, even as they came to accept it as unavoidable. But a philosophical critique drawn from classical Republican thought deeply influenced the founding era. It presented faction, synonymous with party, as an expression of selfishness and corruption that undermined society. The universal tendency to faction marked the philosophical equivalent of original sin. On a different, more practical level, however, Americans looked across the Atlantic to Britain for a recognizable guide to how politics actually worked. English institutions gave colonial America a template. English politics, with their shifts and turns, offered a ready example within a shared culture. If the parallels never exactly fit, they still provided a reference point long after independence set Britain and the United States on their separate histories. So organized parties began in Britain during the late 17th century as the Stuart court and its opponents battled for influence over Parliament. The exclusion crisis of the early 1680s, an effort to prevent Charles II's Roman Catholic brother James from succeeding him as king, that marked a key transition as both sides rallied support in the country to bolster their strength to gain majorities in the House of Commons. Those pushing exclusion became known as Whigs. Their royalist opponents landed the name Tories. Both of those labels started out as epithets that the partisans themselves embraced. There's an echo of the symbols of donkey and elephant in the American system. The two parties split logically along the divide between government and opposition. The king's government and its not necessarily entirely loyal opposition. Efforts to elect supporters in parliamentary constituencies, that extended the rivalry between Whigs and Tories beyond the House of Commons, beyond metropolitan politics in the capital, to constituencies. Party set a language for discussing politics, for doing politics. What became known as the Rage of Party, that lasted from the 1690s through the reign of Queen Anne, it escalated between Whigs and Tories. Observers likened relations between the parties as mixing oil with vinegar, or the lion laying down with the lamb. Efforts to elect MPs, members of the House of Commons, with elections every 3 years or sooner, kept tensions simmering, if not at a rolling boil. The effort to persuade supporters with pamphlets, handbills, along with speeches, platform speeches, put forth arguments. Other aspects of electioneering, from treating supporters with food and drink to the management of elections to ensure votes when the count would be tallied, that shaped political culture through the English-speaking Atlantic. And the result found expression not only in ideas, but also in the way people approached politics as an activity. Now, George I's succession brought an important change. The new king marginalized Tories. He thought more loyal to the Stuarts than to his own Hanoverian line. He chose ministers exclusively among Whigs. Rather than a competition between parties, British politics then became a competition within a single party. Sir Robert Walpole established a Whig supremacy that continued after he fell from power in 1742. It lasted decades until the accession of George III. A split between court and country defined politics, with Tories and opposition Whig factions, the word faction comes in here, against a court Whig faction that upheld its ascendancy through patronage and royal support. Party rooted in principle gave way to faction driven by the pursuit of office and of patronage. Tory views persisted among backwoods squires and parsons, but most active politicians claimed to be Whigs. The question was instead what kind of Whig and what it meant to be a Whig. Now, opposition Whigs like William Pitt the Elder challenged the court Whig ascendancy with arguments from a wider country party tradition. More a movement than an organized group, the country party reached beyond Whigs to include Tories and to include an older Commonwealth tradition drawn from the parliamentary side of the English Civil Wars. It argued that court Whigs threatened public liberties and Parliament's independence by their use of patronage. Salaries, government contracts, and borrowing served metropolitan financiers and merchants. The country paid the bill through steep taxation. Appealing to public virtue marked a counterpoint in a case against metropolitan corruption. Lord Bolingbroke, a former Tory, appealed for a patriot king to curb corruption. Opposition Whigs looked instead for wider public participation to serve the same end. Pitt used country party rhetoric. The elder Pitt used country party rhetoric to bolster his own stance as an independent patriot serving the national interest as opposed to party or faction. Toryism never took hold in America, except as a label for loyalists during the struggle for independence. Ironically, Tory returned to use in Britain in the late 1760s to denote apostate Whigs who now backed ministers in George III. Country party rhetoric had a much greater impact across the Atlantic in what became the United States, even as it faded into irrelevance in Britain. Critiques of faction and opposition attacks on corruption and on vested interest, that became a leading part of American political language. Versions of those arguments resonate to the present day. Americans engaged those ideas directly because they crossed the Atlantic in print without an interpreter to soften their tone or mediate their content, mediate them, translate to us for a different audience. Concerns about taxation and its use to support office holders and advantage well-connected insiders, that resonated as well, particularly in Virginia and in Massachusetts, where that language explained local concerns. So the lessons Americans drew from British politics fit neatly with other lessons drawn from philosophical writings. Practical examples and rhetoric shaped how the founders saw faction as an expression of self-interest at odds with virtue. John Adams, it's interesting, spoke of the real revolution as being a revolution in men's minds, with independence the consequence. So Republican virtue in America replaced an imperial patriotism that had bound the colonies as part of a British Atlantic world. Now, as the American crisis loomed in the 1770s, Edmund Burke made an effort to justify party with a pamphlet called Thoughts on the Present Discontents. He warned that patronage and royal influence under George III had curtailed Parliament's independence. He argued for principled opposition to Lord North's government and its policies. The struggle for place and emolument, patronage, weakened opposition, but so did the insistence by leading men on acting as individuals rather than cooperating with friends. Burke defined party as, I quote, a body of men united for forming by their joint endeavors the national interest upon some particular principle in which they are all agreed. Whigs of Queen Anne's reign, Burke argued, saw that no man could act effectively alone. Cooperation required mutual confidence, but that confidence could only be shared when men were bound together by common opinions, common affections, and common interests. The commitment to stand or fall together gave party a weight no individual could match alone. Burke distinguished party operating on legitimate principle from self-interested faction. While he justified party as the means for parliamentary opposition to hold ministers to account, its bond of principled cooperation also gave an administration, a cabinet, a more firm base than faction could. Dismissing the cry of men, not measures, and with it the independence the elder Pitt insisted upon as the hallmark of political virtue, Burke offered an alternative view from the country party rhetoric that resonated across the Atlantic. He gave Whig followers of Lord Rockingham, Burke was Rockingham's private secretary, he gave them a later justification for acting as a party. Now, although Burke defended the American cause, Americans did not embrace his view on party. Decades later, in 1834, when American Whigs used Burke's arguments against Andrew Jackson, the frontier Napoleon, they completely ignored Burke's defense of political party. An essay in the New England Magazine with nearly the same title as Burke's pamphlet set Burke's charges paralleled. It set Burke's charges against George III alongside their own attack on Jackson, but completely skipped the section on political party. Party remained suspect to Americans even then. Certainly in the founding era, party retained the connotation of faction. James Madison described faction in Federalist 10 as, and again I quote, a group of citizens united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community, my emphasis added. Mm-hmm. He stressed how factions threaten rights or the public good through the struggle for private advantage. Where Burke saw party unity as a balancing force, Madison treated it as a source of mischief. Parties emerged during Washington's administration, but Americans saw them as a flaw rather than a feature of public life. Theory conflicted with practice. Now, in Britain, historians describe a second age of party in the late 18th century into the early 19th century. A Whig party revived under Rockingham and then Charles James Fox. The Rockingham and then the Foxite Whigs claimed for themselves the title Whig. A revived Tory party from among the followers of the younger Pitt took the label Tory. Active politicians in Britain by 1800 accepted the idea of party as legitimate. Lord Castlereagh doubted public business could be managed any other way. The success of Britain's government, he insisted, derived from the conflict of party chastened by the principles of the Constitution, subdued by decorum. A Foxite Whig, Thomas Creevey, said that without party nothing could be done. John Wilson Croker, a Tory deeply influenced by Burke, contrasted party with faction. Where faction had a deep destabilizing effect before, party brought stability. Old labels returned as supporters of Rockingham and then Fox took the possession of Whig. Their opponents became Tories. Now, these decades saw other trends in Britain. They saw the expansion of the political sphere beyond the capital and beyond parliamentary and court politics to encompass the whole country, the growth of the press, the spread of literacy, provincial interest. And this, the period from the late 18th into the 19th century was the golden age of the provinces. This is a period in Britain where politics became national, and by becoming national, they incorporated larger interest groups. Party became a part of that process, as both opposition, the Whigs, and a Tory government under Pitt's political heirs, eventually Lord Liverpool, struggled for advantage and bid for support from outsiders. The war against revolutionary France and Napoleon gave ministers an advantage that ended in 1815 with peace. And the years after Waterloo saw terrible dislocations during a period of post-war adjustment. Again, the struggle for advantage, parliamentary reform became an issue. Whigs, led by a man called Henry Broome, a lawyer, parliamentarian, and publicist, Broome operated essentially as a party chairman before the job existed, using the platform at campaigns, using public meetings, using petitions to build support in the country and to challenge the government. Government responded in somewhat similar ways to try and build support. During this period, the Whigs gained the advantage. When the Tories split over personal differences, Broome and Lord Grey established a Whig ascendancy. A Whig government came to power in 1830, passed a Reform Act that changed the structure of parliamentary representation, and that established an ascendancy for the Whigs that lasted for decades until 1886. Now, these events had more importance for the United States than often acknowledged. They showed an example of how party worked within representative governments, and representative governments in an expanding national politics. Newspapers and periodicals carried them across the Atlantic. The great reviews of the day, the Whig Edinburgh Review and its Tory rivalry, the Quarterly, fought the political struggle in their pages, and again, fought it in a way that Americans could follow closely. If the parallels were never exact, British influence provided a language and reference points for Americans to discuss their own politics. And my colleagues on the panel will develop how that turned out. Thank you.